Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Welcome to the Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast, everyone. I'm your host, John Lostwith. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
So, guys, in 1981, something really monumental happened. And, we're celebrating its 35th anniversary, and we're celebrating the 35th anniversary of Big Trouble. Escape from New York. Oh, yeah, and it's John's birthday. Happy birthday, Living Good.
Boy, and I was actually born in Manhattan.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, I was born in Manhattan. Escape from New York. Like, that was everyone trying to get away when I was born. They knew I'd be trouble.
I almost said Big Trouble in Little China, so I messed up my dang punchline. But happy birthday and almost birthday to Big Trouble. No, I just did it again. To Escape from New York. And I don't know when Big Trouble was released with Tim Allen, but, you know, I'm sure it's your, 10-year, 6-month, 3-day anniversary, and I think that's great for you, too.
John Levigan, what are your birthday plans?
You know, my birthday plans really came down to having a beer and podcasting about movies, because I'm old now, and we were discussing earlier that when you get old, like, and your birthday falls on a weekday, it's like you don't get a birthday.
Yeah.
Like, all you listeners who are in your 20s, it's like whatever day is your birthday, you're like, it could be a Tuesday. You're like, it's going to be like Ragnarok. Or now I'm like, I went to the gym, so I'm kind of tired.
Yeah. Maybe I'll have a beer later. I don't know. We'll see.
A beer, fall asleep with that beer in my hand, halfway finished.
Yeah. What's
I was just managing the happy birthdays on Facebook today, just letting everyone know that I liked it. And it's like, that was exhausting. That's what 35 is. Like, that was exhausting.
See, you gotta do what I do. Like, it's the lazy way to do it. Just make one post saying like, hey everybody, thanks for all the birthday wishes. It's a lot easier than just liking every individual comment.
No, just just so people know that I saw it though. Like, it doesn't just get lost in the sea of like so-and-so, and 100 other people wish you a happy birthday.
See, I'm too lazy to even do that. I'm just like, you know what? I'll just do this, and I'll take care of it.
Wait. So something happened on Twitter today, and we're talking about laziness, and this reminds me. I have a theory that all the people, the humans in Zion, in the Matrix, the people who escaped from the Matrix who were in the city of Zion, I think they were all lazy. Like, I mean all of them lazy. Because you know how, like, so Neo isn't a kung fu master in reality, right? But he still knows it because they uploaded it. Mm-hmm. So this dude was telling me how, you know, ever notice how after you watch a movie like Mission Impossible, all your actions are performed more precisely? And I'm like, yeah, and after a Rocky movie, you want to go train? And then he joked around with me. He's like, yeah, and don't even mess with me after I've seen The Matrix. And so I started thinking, like, why didn't the people in the Matrix like upload some like molecular gastronomy knowledge so they could turn all of these basic components that they have to eat into something tastier through various dilutions or boiling certain things off or combining it with simple compounds and preparing them different ways? Instead, they're eating slop.
Well, there's only so much you could do with like dirt and rocks. Right.
What did they have to eat? Kill bots that they made en masse and their engineering room and tell me they didn't have technology.
Yeah, it doesn't mean they had crops or livestock to work with.
No, you don't need that. You don't need that. I mean, they're in the future. They're hacking into the machine's knowledge. They could find out how to turn lead into gold. They could make these basic amino acids into something tasty. They could synthesize beef.
I mean, aren't they worried about living? Like, I guess, like, slop is kind of like an afterthought because they're too busy being chased by these stupid squibbies.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there were a lot of people in Zion who pretty much just seemed to be schlubbing around. Like, they could be
dance parties.
they could just upload for free this knowledge. It's not like going to school and building debt. Like, they just upload it, right? Unless you're born in Zion. If you're natural, you can't do it. But for the rescues from the Matrix, just upload that knowledge. Make something a little tastier.
Yes.
I'm just saying. Look, I'm just saying. I think that they could have been doing a little more effort with that stuff that looks like a mix of cream corn and sausage gravy.
You know, and I think in every movie I've ever watched, I've hated watching slop eating because the people hunch over their plates and they hold a spoon like they would never hold it in real life.
Like they're in prison.
And they start shoveling it like even like, you know, any other movie with like peasants or The Matrix or anything, whenever people are eating slop or like whenever someone's really hungry and they get handed bread, they just shovel it in their mouths. Like, eating slop has always annoyed me on screen.
I think that's how I should do a post.
The ten times eating slop has annoyed me.
That actually sounds like really entertaining to me. Like, I'm down. Like, you see them eating so fast, you feel like they choke on it.
Yeah.
But so hold on. I got another little bit that someone brought up about our podcast specifically. Someone was talking to me, and there was a time that we got into some conversation about Rodney Dangerfield and Back to School.
Mm-hmm.
Did we know this? Did you know this, Mark, that Rodney Dangerfield was in fact a competitive diver?
No.
So this guy, this was Dirty D, Dirtbag D, or Dirty D, or Darth Dirtbag, who's given us some listener questions from Australia. He says, was listening to your podcast the other day, and by the way, fun fact, Rodney Dangerfield was in fact a competitive diver. I cannot, however, confirm his ability to chuck a triple Wendy.
So he and Jason Statham had a lot in common.
Weren't we talking about Captain Ron or something, or Kurt Russell stumbling and failing up a triple Wendy?
Yeah, we said one would do it by accident, and then the other one would just sort of fail up on it.
Well, I was pretty entertained by that. Any of you listeners who ever really like something about our podcast, do share it because we love talking about it.
That's right. Hey, speaking of listeners, let's start off the podcast like we do every podcast. Listener questions. Mark?
Yep. And this one's from Facebook, and it's from Will the Cook, and it said, if you could change one plot point in a movie to turn it from what you consider an average movie to a great movie, what would you change? And listen, guys, normally I'll pass it off to one of you, but I gotta do this. All right, and you've heard me complain about this multiple times, but I got two movies, all right? So one plot point is in Pacific Rim, instead of having one stupid hole where they could just cover with a steel grate, in Pacific Rim there should have been like four portals. So that makes sense for the world to have their own robots. The monsters pop out at different times. That could have made the circumstances a lot more dire and a whole lot less dumb than just one. And then in Godzilla, which is like, I love Godzilla. He's a cranky old monster who takes a nap. But they kill Bryan Cranston like a third of the way in, and then it's just his really boring son running around. So just keep him alive. You know, and that kid's a good actor too. So just keep Bryan Cranston alive throughout the movie. He's like the heart and soul of that film. So in two steps, you do four holes in Pacific Rim. That means the world all need their individual robots, right? And it gets rid of the whole, why don't they just surround the one portal and put nukes over it? Done. Right. And then that one guy goes in the brain. He knows which hole they're going to go through next. They blow it up. It's all done. Perfect. You know, one stays open. Sequel. Right. Godzilla, keep Bryan Cranston alive. Have him and his son, Aaron Taylor Johnson from Kick-Ass, Avengers Age of Ultron. Keep him alive and have the father son going to help save the world. Like, that just makes so much more sense and would make it a more human film.
You know, while you're on Godzilla, when I saw the trailer for Godzilla, there was a scene that I thought there was one scene in the trailer, and the way they cut it in the trailer and the way they scored it in the trailer was in no way the way that it was cut, presented, or scored in the movie. And that was kind of like the Archangel, the guy's diving, skydiving down, trying to do the strategic maneuver on Godzilla, and they're going through like all the smoke and stuff so you can't see through, and then they know they're going to be dangerously near the skyscrapers and stuff, and it had this operatic music, and when I saw the trailer, like, I was moved. I had chest tingles. That scene alone had me excited to see the movie. Then I saw the movie, And it was, it wasn't scored that way. That music wasn't even in the movie, pretty much. And it was cut in a way that wasn't very dramatic. And that scene was just kind of there. And so I'm thinking they should have had whoever cut and assembled that sequence for the trailer involved in cutting it on the editing room floor for the movie.
Yeah. The one condition is Godzilla still has to take a nap.
He's got to take a nap.
I mean, he won a battle. He takes a nap. Everyone thinks he's dead. He gets up groggy and swims away. Like, that's worth the price of admission right there.
I mean, I'd be tired if I took out those two mudos.
That's right. But in Pacific Rim, add a few more portals. Boom. Done. Every complaint I have about it, it's like, okay, I get it.
Even one portal, and it's literally a portal, though. It's not a permanent thing.
Yeah, it just moves.
It opens unpredictably.
Yeah, perfect. As opposed to one that's just there. Like, that's like, just...
It's like an earthquake. We know it's coming in an hour. In an hour, we cannot transport five Jaegers from around the world to one spot. We're lucky if we can get one halfway there.
Yeah, and that makes sense for the different countries to have it. And like one plot point, one, and it would have saved me, you know, so much complaining.
Guillermo, your co-director's right here. Give us a call.
Listen, I will write you a sequel in 20 minutes. I will slam on this computer thing. Come up with a few decent words. Write monsters vs. robots. We got a script. P2.
You just described like typing like my grandmother would. Like I'm gonna slam on this computer thing. I'm gonna make a story out of it.
I'll play Mozart on my. I'll look like Mozart on my keyboard. Just come up with the most brilliant script.
Nice.
All right, that's mine. So what do you got, Levin? Good.
So this is kind of out there, but. So I recently saw Copland, and I see Ray Liotta, and I recently saw Unforgettable, also Ray Liotta, and I started thinking about Ray Liotta, and we always think about Kurt Russell. So I was thinking, like, what if Ray Liotta replaced Martin Short in Captain Ron? Now, you see, then the father figure of the family isn't like this bumbling loser who's trying to be strong. He's someone who we know normally to be a strong character. And I think it would be more interesting if a naturally strong character was constantly being won over by this bumbling Captain Ron instead of like a not very manly, you know, kind of squirrely, uptight guy.
So, but I think it's a PG-13 movie, so Ray Liotta would be doing a lot of Joe Pesci from Home Alone, like Razza Frazza Fricka, Captain Rana, Baba Jabba.
Yeah, he could even be doing like what he did later in Heartbreakers, where you know he was kind of bumbling.
Oh yeah,
but he's still like a naturally strong character who most people like in his movie roles. And then I even thought, like, what if Ray Liotta, for that same reason, replaced Martin Short in Pure Luck? Like, I don't know. I kind of feel like. Like Ray Liotta would bring an interesting angle. Like if the character was a stronger character, but then put in these bumbling situations instead of giving the person who looks like he'd be in these situations. So it's less of a plot point and more like a change in the character's nature.
Yeah. So change of a character's nature, change in the plot.
All right.
But honestly, when you brought up Godzilla, I was much more pleased with my Godzilla change from the editing. What would you come up with, Lazavath?
Okay, so this one I struggled with a little bit because I was trying to think of a singular plot point that could swing a movie, you know, to the other side. And, you know, I'm honestly not sure if this would have made the movie better in my eyes. But in Man of Steel, when, spoiler alert, Superman kills General Zod. Like, I don't know. For some reason, it never really sat right with me. Because, I don't know. I mean, I don't have a problem with dark heroes. Like, I actually like them. But I don't really associate Superman with, you know, that action. It just, you know, ever since I saw Man of Steel, it just never really sat right with me. So I would love to have seen a movie where he doesn't do that. I don't know if I would have liked it better. But
I'm getting two things out of this.
Yeah.
One, you said spoiler alert, so we're just hoping that we didn't ruin it for anyone who didn't see that movie in the last 4 years.
Don't watch it; it's terrible.
That's a mix.
Two, are you suggesting like he put him in a sleeper hold kind of thing, or like if he covered his eyes, could he keep his hand there? Do you mean something like that? I don't like. What
see,
are we?
I don't really know, to be honest, what he would have done as opposed to not killing him. But
so it's just like somehow he was able to incapacitate him without killing him and without having a bunch of innocent lives.
Because it was such it was such a cheap thing, though, because he was like, I'm going to burn this family. You have no choice but to rip my head off. And it's like, oh, brother.
Yeah. Like, it's not like Superman is an idiot. He was they made him a very smart guy. Like, I mean, not like, you know, he's not doing physics on walls like Good Will Hunting, but he seemed very, very smart and self-aware. So when they were fighting and punching holes through buildings, he must have realized that innocent lives were being killed just from chunks of concrete falling 20 stories down on people's cars and stuff. Like, people have been dying through this whole fight.
Mm-hmm. He could have gone up 200 yards and done an air battle.
Yeah. Like, I'm just saying, though, it's like people were dying almost the whole time. The only time people weren't dying as collateral damage was when they were fighting in the street and it was that giant, you know, Superman evil guy and that woman and Zod. Like, it was the 3-on-1.
Oh, in the little town?
Yeah, like that time it was just out in the street. But when they're fighting in the city, people would have been dying every minute. Every 10 seconds, every 5 seconds, someone was dying. So it's not like all of a sudden there's extra urgency to a few lives. Like, in other words, it's as if Superman was totally oblivious to the fact that people were dying as collateral damage this whole time. Yeah. And that kind of strikes me as its own little like reckless plot hole in his character.
Right.
Yeah, he could have like flown him to space and put him in some space shackles.
Right? Like, I mean, I'm not questioning like the reasoning or like the argument of why he did it. It's just, you know, like I said, Superman has such a deep seated history in our culture. So like the idea of him killing someone just never really sat right with me for some reason. I totally understood why he did it. I just, you know, I wish like I saw like a different like result, you know, or answer they could have come up with.
So. Yeah, sacrifice I don't know. His dad did.
Yeah, I don't know if the movie would have been better though if they changed that plot point.
I think that's a fair criticism though, Lazabeth, because when there was no positive criticism to him deciding to kill Zod that I'm aware of. Some people might have been indifferent or thought he had to do it, but a lot of people were negative. A lot of people were like, Superman doesn't decide who dies,
right.
And he's super. He presumably could have gone about it another way.
Yeah. Space prison. Take him to the prison that was in lockout and put him in there.
No, it might have been the filmmaker's way of bringing Superman into the modern day world of superheroes. You know, modern day superheroes are a little bit more grittier. They're darker. Yeah. So that might have been their way of kind of Nolanizing him a little bit. That's the term I just came up with.
Yeah. But it felt like – this is going to sound weird, but it felt like faux Nolan, the way Zack Snyder did it. There's a bourbon out there, Old Forester birthday bourbon. It's only 12 years old, but they age it differently, so it tastes older than what it is, but you can still know that it's like a 12-year. And that's the way I felt about Man of Steel. Like, it was just – it was Nolan light. Like, it wasn't aged – we knew the age statement on it. Like, no matter what they gussied it up to, we still knew what it was. So
so they should have waited a couple more years to release it.
Yeah, and then not kill as many people and not have Lois Lane introduce herself as like, I'm a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter.
I'm spunky.
Like, she's a great actress, too. She's like she's an Oscar-winning, amazing actress. And then they just gave her nothing in that role. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
All
right.
I mean, all they really gave her was good hair.
Yeah, so the answer is spunky.
Yeah, spunky and good hair. All right. So thank you for that wonderful listener question, Will, right?
Yep.
I can never remember these guys. Living Good, what's the topic we're talking about today?
You know, it's been a while since we just sat down and talked about some scary movies. And that's what I like to talk about more than anything. And Mark has, the last year, been writing a lot of critical, analytical articles about the horror genre in general. So today we picked three recent popular releases in the horror genre. They all did something kind of a little differently.
Very, 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 very differently, yeah.
And so we think that these are three interesting watches. We don't all agree on liking all of them, but they all brought something to the table that made us all interested in them. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
And the first, yeah?
They all hit above their weights, I feel like, or try to. These aren't stock. The people who made these didn't want to make just some slasher. I think there's a lot of thought put into all three of these movies. And as far as horror goes, I think they're worth watching because all three of them offer the genre something very different and kind of exciting.
Yeah, I got to agree with that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the first of those three movies that we're going to discuss today is Bone Tomahawk. Now, out of the three of us, I believe that Mark champions this movie the most. So, Mark, would you like to introduce Bone Tomahawk?
I mean, I do training montages with the Blu-ray in my hand. Like in Philadelphia, I ran up those steps with the Blu-ray in my hand, and when I finished it, I was jumping up and down with it. People were surrounding me. You know, I had Bone Tomahawk flying up in the air. And Bone Tomahawk is a 132-minute horror western about good men hunting down some troglodytes who kidnap some people from their town. So it's basically like The Searchers, the John Wayne classic, the Eli Roth cannibal film. And it was written and directed by this guy, S. Craig Zahler. He is actually a guy who wrote westerns, so the western influence is very evident in this, and it almost plays like a novel. It's a very lyrical film. I think the weakest parts are the violence in themselves, but it was a $2 million budget, and they only shot it in 21 days. So there is going to be budget stretching, and the 21 days was a nightmare to shoot because there's a lot of individual shots in this film, but it's one of my 10 favorite of 2015. It tied Hateful Eight at number 10, and you know, it has everyone's favorite Kurt Russell. But what I like the most about it is just it's not so much the torture that is evident, but I like the lyrical dialogue and the plotting violence that leads up to it.
So when I saw this movie, actually, can we back up in time? Let's actually wind back the clock to before this movie came out. Yeah. And our first impressions. And when it was the buzz was first hitting the internet, they were talking about this new Kurt Russell movie, Bone Tomahawk, this edgy, dark horror western. And when I would read the synopsis, all I felt like I was reading was a western. Mm-hmm. And then the trailer came out, and the trailer, I was still kind of thinking it was a western with a couple of heavy, darker scenes. But then I saw the movie, you know, it obviously transformed into something not fitting a western for a good portion of it. And so, like, when it first came out, my impression of it was really like, where's the horror all the way through the trailer? And it really wasn't until I saw it and I was halfway through the movie that it really kind of struck me that, okay, not a western, not just a western.
And this film is really is kind of like a perfect example of the recent horror hybrids, as I call them. They are you know, steeped in the horror genre, but they're, you know, with Spring, there's romance. There are these horror films that, you know, people could debate it's not horror, it's Western. These are films that are taking things they love from the horror genre and making them their own. This is going to sound weird, but it's like a horror movie that wants to be a good film. And does that make
you
sense?
You know, we've been going back and forth in several podcasts about, like, which genre is it and where do we draw the line and the subjectivity. So you mentioned Spring. Spring is never scary, but I would call it a horror movie, right? But Bone Tomahawk takes a lot of plays from The Hills Have Eyes and The Wrong Turn Handbook, and yet at the same time, I'm tempted to call it more horrific than Spring.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a scene, spoiler alert for everything in this podcast, by the way, today, everybody. But there's a scene where someone is being held up by the ankles while naked, and he is hatcheted in half, starting with his little man bits all the way down, and then they rip the remaining half of him apart like they're just ripping apart a turkey or something, and his guts come flopping out and whatever. But I mean, it was brutal. Like, that scene and the amount that they chose to show you, that's out of like a Wrong Turn movie.
Yeah, and
that is not a brutal scene from a Western. That in that moment, it had left Western for 90 seconds.
Yeah, and this is like this, and I guess for me, why I love this movie so much are the characters. Richard Jenkins is in it, and actually, this movie got nominated for several Independent Spirit Awards. They got nominated for Best Screenplay, and they got nominated for Best Supporting Actor. So he's like alongside Idris Elba for, you know, Beasts of No Nation, Paul Dano, Love and Mercy. This is like a weird horror cannibal film that got nominated for a lot of awards. But what I like the most is just the dialogue. There's a scene where Richard Jenkins, they're on this flat prairie, and he's like, you know, I know the earth is round, but it doesn't appear so right here. And there's just this cool scene. There's a character moment in the middle of the night where Richard Jenkins, who he's the deputy to Kurt Russell's sheriff, and you think he's like this doofy guy, but as the movie builds on, you realize he's been in war and surgery and he's seen it all. He lost his wife. But there's a scene where he's like, hey, you know, Kurt, I try to read, he didn't say Kurt, but he's like, I try to read in a bathtub, but I'm always dropping my book in the bathtub. And like, they go have this discussion about how to read in a bathtub. He's like, well, why don't you get one of those orchestra stands and then get a towel next to the book so you can flip the pages. This is a movie that has cool little character moments, and you could tell an author of, you know, novels wrote it. And it was actually his first draft. His first draft was the final draft for this movie, which you can tell because it's 2 hours and 12 minutes. But I don't know, like, this is a movie where, like, there's a thing called the German, what do you call it,
The telescope.
Or yeah, the telescope. Yeah. The telescope has more of a character than most people in horror movies. So I know I'm talking about this a lot, Lazbeth. What did you think about Bone Tomahawk?
Okay, so I'm going to go against the grain here. Well, first off, let me say I love the movie. I love Westerns in general, and this is like another, you know, solid example of a great Western movie. I'm going to go against the grain and say, like, this is just, it's not really a horror movie. It's just a really good Western. You know, the brutality of the troglodytes, you know, they're scary. But for me, like, Westerns, they're always like a metaphor for, like, the expansion and conquest of the American West. I think, like, the troglodytes, they're just, like, you know, to get, like, really kind of artsy-fartsy poetic here, like, they're just, like, a metaphor of, like, the uncertainty and the brutal, you know, savage nature of the, you know, unknown, like, frontier back then. You know, it's just, it's really just what Westerns are. You know, they're brutal, they're brooding, they're slow burns, which this movie definitely was. But I feel like this is, if I had to choose one genre for this movie, I would go Western all the way.
Oh, that's me too. I don't consider this a horror. Yeah. I just think it's weird that it's more horrific than Spring.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I love the brutality in this movie. Like, because, like, it was graphic, but not gratuitous. Like, it wasn't, like, every 5 seconds, you know, like, teen slasher. Like, it was, like, always done at the right point. So it had, like, the right amount of impact, yeah. You know?
And there's one thing, while watching it the second time for this pod, just to have some notes. So they have the guy cut in half, and the main guy with the tusks coming from his face that I guess he just put in there, he's not an animal, he's a man. But, like, there's some guts kicking out, and the main troglodyte just kind of kicks the guts casually out of the guy's stomach. Like, they've done it a million times before.
Yeah.
So, like, the first time I watched it, I was like, ugh. And then the second time I saw him do, like, this little casual kick. I'm like, that's really thought out. Like, these guys thought out the violence in this movie. And what I, you know, the torture wasn't my favorite part, but I love the plodding violence of the troglodytes. Like, they were just these big hulking guys that made a lot of noise when they ran. And the violence was, like, really frenzied in the gunfights and the fights. Like, it wasn't pretty, any of it. And I liked how plodding it was. It looked like, you know, I'm not going to compare it to The Descent was better, but when the women spelunkers are battling the crawlers, that was like the most primal fighting. This kind of had that vibe to it too. It was just like nothing was pretty about it. And I feel like that does violence and, you know, slaughter a service when you show it at its ugliest. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I love how the troglodytes were explained, or like kind of explained to the audience. You know, they had the Native American professor, you know, slash expert come in. It's like, you know, I wouldn't want to mess with these guys. Like, they're not even human. You know, that just sets the kind of the visceral brutality of like of the nature of these guys. It was a very great way to set up these characters. And Speaking of just great characters, can I just say how great Matthew Fox's character was? Like, I felt like he did a lot.
Give him more work. I wish he was in more significant roles.
So I guess he was just like an expert Native American killer, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I guess he was like a rich dude slash Native American exterminator. But like, yeah, he was just like, he was dapper, but also very disciplined. I guess that's the right word. Like when it comes to killing these people. Because, like, you know, like around camp time, like, he'd always set up the traps. He would always, like, shoot first, ask questions later. He also had, like, a really great death scene. You know, I'm going to try to take out, like, as many of these guys as possible. And, you know, that doesn't really come to pass. But, yeah, he was great. His hair looked amazing, too. I don't know what kind of...
And his horse. So there's a scene where these people, it's Kurt Russell, Matthew Fox, Patrick Wilson, who we haven't even gotten to yet, and Richard Jenkins, they're sleeping, and their camp is disrupted by two men. And Matthew Fox just kills them. He's like, they're a raiding party. And so they move camp. The raiding party, I guess, catches up to him and takes their horses. And Matthew Fox is like, you know, they wouldn't have taken my horse. He says some racial slurs, whatever. But
And, yeah, like he's too disciplined for that.
Yeah, he called them greasers. He's like, and then he said my horse wouldn't be taken by some greaser. But then it turns out his horse didn't run, and they shot it. And so he had like this close bond with his horse, and he walks up to his horse and has to kill it. But the horse like didn't want to go, and he got killed. Like this movie, like you feel for the horses, you love the telescope. Like Patrick Wilson and his wife, the wife, she was like really, I liked her a lot. I think Lily Simmons is a good actress. I thought she carried the dialogue really well. I like how she said that men are stupid. Patrick Wilson's also in it, but he plays this guy. I don't know if he's a rancher or not, but he was out on the roof one night being an idiot in a storm and he broke his leg. And so he's with them. And he ends up getting left. Richard Jenkins, Matthew Fox, and Kurt Russell leave him behind, and he eventually catches up. Oh, spoilers! But he, you know, takes out the troglodytes and saves the day. But there's a cool scene where it all went wrong for the three men, and Patrick Wilson's looking at this thing, and he goes, "This is where it capsized." Like, I love that. Like, you know, he saw it and he walked around the long way. Like, I didn't see a lot of this movie coming. Like, I didn't really know where it was going. I thought Richard Jenkins in the beginning was annoying, but then I just love the guy.
Same here. Yeah. He started out annoying and bumbling, and then you found out more about him, and you realized in hindsight it fit.
Yeah, and, like, Patrick Wilson was, like, he figured out those things that were in the troglodytes' necks, and, like, I don't know. And this is going to sound crazy. Megan and I, my wife and I, were watching it, but the weakest link almost in this movie is Kurt Russell. Like, I think he had the hardest time with the dialogue. He can destroy Tarantino dialogue, no problem. But I don't know if it was his dialogue that wasn't that good or the other supporting characters were better. But I wouldn't say he's the weak link. He's obviously not a weak link, but he was my least favorite character of the bunch.
I think he had to be the most subtle, really. And he just doesn't do subtle really well.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
That's, and also, this is going to be random, but Alan Rickman just passed away, and I was listening to a podcast about him. And when he won his BAFTA for Robin Hood, his speech was like, sometimes subtlety isn't needed. I thought that was kind of funny. But he didn't pull off the subtlety as well. But, you know, I still love seeing it. And I love the line at the end, Kurt Russell is dying, and he looks at Richard Jenkins. And he's like, you know, say goodbye to my wife and I'll say hello to yours. Like,
yeah, that was,
I was like, oh my gosh. Like, so I'm getting all these feels while people are laying around cut in half. I love this movie. A random fact, Timothy Oliphant was going to be Matthew Fox, but the production got pushed. So then Matthew Fox got the role.
Well, I mean, I don't think you're wrong with either actor.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think either was great, but I'm kind of happy Oliphant's going to keep getting work. I'm happy Fox got this role because now people are like, oh, hey, Matthew Fox.
He's got that Lost money. You know,
it's too bad he dropped off because after Lost, he had a lot of kind of like DUI and drunken disorderly activity going on, and I think that's why he wasn't in much for a long time.
Yeah, he spent like a year on World War Z, and then they cut all of his role out.
Yeah, I mean, and then he finally got that Alex Cross thing, but that – in my opinion, turned out to be a total dud.
Yeah.
Even though he played an interesting role and an intense character, the movie didn't really have the follow through to help him out that much.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting is that, like,
I'm glad this came along for him. I'm done. Glad this came along for him, though.
At the beginning of the movie, I felt like Matthew Fox is kind of out of his depth as far as this character goes, because I'm just like, well, I'm not really feeling this kind of this dapper Western gentleman guy. You know, it's just like, it just feels more Matthew Fox than anything. But as the movie went on, you just kind of felt like, you felt like Matthew Fox just like kind of got lost in the character. You know, he was just like really kind of vicious, you know, but calm, cool, and collected at the same time. It was very, very awesome to watch.
I can't speak for any actors, but I feel like this kind of dialogue is stuff that you just live for. Like, to be able to, like, speak Tarantino dialogue or maybe Sorkin dialogue. And I'm not comparing this script to that. But I think, like, just the way the script flowed. Like, these guys, I don't know, they were playing characters. They got to get into, like, a genre. I think this is, like, a good character piece. And like you said, the Native American man that was like, don't compare me to these troglodytes. Like, I'm not one of them. These guys are terrible. You know, you got them. You have the piano player in the bar. That's really funny. It's just a good, and you can tell a novelist wrote it. The one thing that bothered me is everyone kept calling Richard Jenkins an old man, but then I figured in novel form, it probably would be old man a lot more. So that was like the only kind of qualm I had, is Kurt Russell kept yelling at Richard Jenkins, "Come on, old man! Come on, old man!" Like, everyone kept calling him an old man. I was like, leave Richard Jenkins alone.
Right.
Poor Richard Jenkins. I felt like the beginning of the movie, they were trying to homage some Tombstone out of Kurt Russell, but never quite with the actual authority and power, if you will, or respect that should come with it. And in the beginning, again, like, it's Richard Jenkins, he seemed a little too bumbling in the beginning. Matthew Fox, he didn't quite fit for me either right away. And then Kurt Russell felt like he was, you were trying to insert this Tombstone character in, and then later they worked better together. But in the beginning, I spent the first 15 minutes of this movie thinking that watching it was a mistake. Now, I'm not a rave supporter of this movie. I thought it was cool, though. I'm glad I watched it. It has a lot to offer. But like, for me, the first 15 minutes, I thought I had made a mistake, and then later I came to appreciate the dialogue and the relationships of the characters. It took some easing. For me, for those characters to fit together on screen.
Yeah, if you go into this thinking it's going to be like
Wilson.
Yeah, if you go into this thinking it's going to be a horror movie, you're going to be like, what? And if you go into it thinking it's going to be like a traditional Western, you see the end, you're going to be like, what? So this is it builds, I guess. It's, you know, it's patient. But I get what you're saying. It does start off a little rough. But it, like, at first I thought it was kind of too cute by half, like with David Arquette's dialogue and of course, he's the one that causes all the problems. But it felt like a little bit circa 95. But then you get used to like the flow of the film.
Right.
I gotta tell you, that the opening scene with David Arquette and Sid Haig,
yeah,
that opening scene, now, I thought that was setting the tone for Bone Tomahawk. And then after that, for 40 minutes, it's really calm.
Yeah, that's
it's
a slow
really
burn.
Calm and quiet Western.
Yeah.
And then it gets, and then it amps back up to some brutality. So these cannibals, kind of monstrous cannibal Native Americans with some body modification, they put something in their trachea to make these weird, like, velociraptor sounds. They don't orate normally, and they one of them had tusk modifications inserted into his jaw. Can't imagine that process. They had it was very Hills Have Eyes-ish too, because they had like those women.
Yeah, oh, that's gross. That was gross.
Had their eyes sewn shut, and they were quadruple amputees. And you had these two naked pregnant women, or partially naked pregnant women, quadruple amputees with their eyes sewn shut, just like moaning and squirming around next to each other in some little brood den. Like, that was pretty weird and out there. So it's like, this was, I feel like they did a good job at making these things horrific brutes. I don't think they did a good job delivering them in a daylight atmosphere. I think that if this was more of a dawn and dusk scene, they would have fit a lot better the way that they were presented. And in the daylight, though, with no decorations really, or trophies or remnants of past meals or things like that, or past people's possessions in their den, like it felt when there was all that light, I felt like it actually hurt it.
They kept a very clean den.
They did, and it was a surprisingly smooth floor in that den, as if they sanded it.
Yeah, and they had a sense of humor, too, because they killed a couple of them with opium, and to pay them back, they slit Kurt Russell's chest open and shoved a flask, a piping hot flask into his guts.
God, that was so weird. That was... so weird. That scene, I don't know if that was awful or great, but I mean I just sat back like kind of giggling uncomfortably as I watched that happen.
I do want to hire whoever cleans their den, though. I think they got a good den.
That den was immaculate. It was too immaculate.
You have all the dens, like, you know, Jeepers Creepers, there's a messy den. You know, Freddy just has all the boilers, you know, that's not that great. I want to write about which serial killers, like their murderers, has the cleanest area.
Not Michael Myers. I feel like he
Patrick
doesn't care.
Bateman.
Yeah, Michael Myers, he just kind of eats rats.
Yeah. It's not very hygienic.
I'm going to analyze serial killers' rooms.
Hey, guys, quick question.
Other than Patrick Bateman, they're going to be messy.
Yeah.
Quick question. We talked about how novel-like this movie was. So how much of an inspiration do you think Blood Meridian was for this movie? Had to have been a decent amount, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
for those of you who don't know, Blood Meridian is probably the greatest Western novel never filmed.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I hope they don't. Like, that and Confederacy of Dunces, I don't see becoming a film, but Blood Meridian is one of the most. Well, you know what? I think if you took The Wild Bunch and mix it with The Revenant, that's the closest you'll come.
Really?
But, The Wild Bunch has some scenes that are very. Very reminiscent of the book. And then also, wait, did The Wild Bunch come beforehand? I don't know. But, absolutely. The stylized dialogue, the kind of methodical pace, the ultra-violence. You know, there were some Christianity involved, you know, some faith. I think so. I think that book has influenced pretty much I see it.
Yeah, because like when I first heard about this movie and the bill itself as a Western horror, I'm like, well, is it going to try to be the Blood Meridian adaptation everybody's trying to do? So, I don't know. Yeah, you're right. I hope they never make that into a movie. Such a good novel. You should just read it anyway. But
it'll wear you out, but it's beautiful.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know what? Speaking of novels, now's a good time for the listeners to listen to maybe a commercial message about novels in audio form.
Blood Meridian.
Yeah. All right, guys. We'll see you in a little bit.
Hey, y'all. It's Mark. And for you, the listeners of Movies, Films, and Flicks, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, there's a book that I really recommend to you guys. And since we've been talking about horror films tonight, it's a book called Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. It's a wonderful book. It's about 9 hours long, but it walks you through how Alien, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, how the classics were made, Rosemary's Baby. And if you're a fan of horror, if you're a cinephile, and if you're just a fan of classic cinema, I totally recommend Shock Value. It's a wonderful book by Jason Zinnemann. Totally recommend it. So, to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/shark. Again, that's audibletrial.com/shark for your free audiobook.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. That was, I don't know. It's tough coming up with, like, snappy things to say, kind of back from commercial break. You know?
I think you nailed it.
Yeah.
Like, if you wouldn't have said something, I would have been on board.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, living good. Give me another listener question. Or Mark, give me a listener question.
All right, yeah, so good. This one
Somebody
actually comes
me a
from
a listener question.
This comes from Will the Cook again. He just was on fire. So which movie do you think you could survive? 13 Ghosts, 13 Assassins, or the 13th Warrior? And for me, I think it's pretty clear, but Lazvath, what do you think?
I'm going to go with 13 Ghosts.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not saying I would live, but I'd probably live the longest out of those three.
Oh, gosh, that'd be terrifying.
I don't know. I feel like I'd just be the guy just, like, not taking any chances at all. You know? Was it, what's his name?
Matthew Lillard?
He got his back broken in that one.
No. Tony Shalhoub? Who are you thinking of?
Owen Wilson? Like,
Wait, that was the House of...
So you're thinking of The Haunting. You're thinking of The Haunting. That had Liam Neeson, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and Lily Taylor, and Owen Wilson. No, not that.
Okay.
13 Ghosts is the one with Shannon Elizabeth and Tony Shalhoub.
Oh, yeah. You know what? No, I'd probably still survive now.
And, like, the Black Zodiac ghosts, and Matthew Lillard was their ghost expert. And...
I don't, I just
that's all you need to know right there. I just know that if I'm Matthew Lillard, I'm dying.
Dude, that's the... I like him as an actor, but I would... I think the worst thing in the world would be in the house. That would just be the... Ugh. Ugh.
Yeah.
You're just, ugh.
I just want to be in a movie with Shannon Elizabeth.
Yes, there we go.
That's like, that house that's the real was reason. Really cool, by the way, but I wouldn't want to live in it.
No.
Let's just pretend it's not haunted, though. Like, I wouldn't want to live in it because it's weird. Too much glass with the writings on the walls and mechanical elements. It's too weird. It'd be like being in a sci-fi movie where you die. Wait, but, like, as an office, that would be cool.
Was 13 Ghosts, like, Cabin in the Woods before Cabin in the Woods with, like, the way the ghosts were held?
Well, it's like each ghost was in a chamber, and they were oriented throughout the house to act as fuel cells for some kind of, like, bigger event.
I'm flipping through my horror book right now of things not to do. And what you said is number three on list of not to do.
Don't go live in a house that was built to be a machine for some dark function that has 13 fuel cells that are independently occupied by the Dark Zodiac ghosts.
Yeah. That's like our henchman pod. Don't do it. So what about you, Lev? What do you think you could survive?
So I still haven't seen 13 Assassins.
Oh, so, what? So
I would like to think that through sheer ignorance, I would have never traveled where that movie was taking place, and therefore I'd survive because I'd be somewhere else. 13 Ghosts, I'd die. everyone dies unless you're like a combination of lucky and pure of heart, but not just pure of heart. You have to be lucky. And like that movie was all that. Like, you didn't live because you were smart. You lived because you were smart and lucky and pure of heart.
You're too big of a guy to be lucky in a horror movie.
Yeah, that's the problem too, is that like I'm big, and for all my joking, it's like I think I'm a sweet guy in person. So it's like, you know, it's like you put yourself between danger and someone else without really weighing the odds. You're gonna die. You're just like, I'm bigger than them. I can handle this better than them, but I'm still gonna die.
Yeah,
like that would happen. But like, I think that 13th Warrior. I mean, I'm only a quarter Norse and like a quarter Swiss, right? That's it. So I'm only like half my blood gets any of that. That stuff, but the rest is, you know, there's German in there too. It's all Scandinavian-ish, right? So I'm 6'3", 250. Like, I can swing a big sword. I'm not talented with it. I think I'd survive. And those bad guys, even though they thought they were monsters, turned out to be very human, right? So I think I got a good shot there, and I think I got a better shot, Mark, if you are my thunder twin over there.
Listen,
you know,
I would 170% die in 13 Ghosts. All right, I would die. They would bring me back to life. I would die again. I'd become a fuel cell, and then I'd die when, you know, some ghost hunters come in there. 13 Assassins. I don't want to give anything away, but I have a 0.001% chance of living that because it's just the most brutal, bloody, amazing battle. And I freaked out earlier when you said you didn't watch it, which is kind of weird, but it's an awesome film. I mean, it's just a beautiful samurai epic directed by Takashi Miike. But I think I could survive. Like, I think I'm 76% certain I could live in 13th Warrior, because a lot of people do survive. Like, villagers, the peasants live in that. And if you think about it, the king does most of the heavy lifting.
I'm telling you that if you have 76%, I probably have the same-ish. But if we were both there, we both have, like, a 90%
chance. Yeah, I would say 83.
Because both of us are there.
Because the problem is, after, like, let's say you killed one of those bear men, we would, like, high-five and catch arrows. Yes, smack.
And it goes through both of our hands at once as we're high-fiving
into the cave wall
at the acme of the five.
Yep. I mean a lot of the guys, not a lot, but a lot of them do survive. And if you think about the guys that do wipe out pretty early, it's like the archers, it's the guy that reaches for the fire, you know. Like, I'd be more of like the give me a sword. Yeah, I don't picture myself as an archer. All right, I'm not the king. So if I'm just like a dude that's good with the sword and isn't like the lookout, I'm surviving. I'm in the middle of the pack the whole time. It's like a henchman who doesn't put himself out there. You're like a good guy who's kind of in the middle of the pack. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I still can't visualize that. I guess I can visualize Lazavath scrambling around that house away from the ghosts.
Yeah, I can see that too. I think Laz would just lock himself in a room and take a nap.
They're ghosts.
I'm just trying to find out where Shannon Elizabeth was.
Yeah, that's perfect though, because while everyone's chasing them, they're all focusing on Lillard and Elizabeth. You're just kind of walking around the house.
Yeah. Where is everybody?
You got a slice of pizza, a beer.
Yeah.
You actually have an iPod in, and like one of the ghosts is trying to grab you, and you keep like ducking to pick up a quarter, and he falls into a Werner Kinshifter ghost.
Yeah. I feel like this is exactly how like Bill Murray from Caddyshack would survive, just bumbling around like, "Hey, it's a pretty neat house here."
Yeah, and then Hotshots Part 2, Charlie Sheen tries to shoot this guy with an arrow, and he keeps ducking to pick stuff up, and then he has to kill him with a chicken. That would be Lazvath. You wouldn't get killed by a chicken; you would just avoid death. Very luckily, like going, oh, so I got this going for me, and I'm sure. So, all right, so Lazvath is 100% to live in 13 ghosts, and you and I have 83%. And if we don't high five, 90%.
Yeah.
I like it.
All right, I think that's another listener question successfully partially answered.
Yeah, so we had no 100%. So you would have 99%. So we have no 100% on that.
It averages out to less than 100%.
Yeah, there we go.
That's the main
point. That was less than 100% answered.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is good for us, actually.
Yeah.
We're swinging a little bit south of zero most of the time. All right.
Speaking of chances to survive, we know that someone isn't walking out of this movie alive, because everyone who's seen the trailer knows, and we're going to spoil it anyway. We're going to talk about Good Night, Mommy. This is another movie where we didn't all agree on how much we loved it or were unimpressed by it. We're very polarized reviews. But this is the story of a woman who returns home bandaged beyond recognition to her twin sons, who are, I'm guessing, around 10 years old. She doesn't get the warmest reception from her sons. There seems to be an immediate distrust of sorts. And throughout the movie, the distrust builds, the intensity to the consequences of that distrust build. And there's kind of a dissociative element between the mother and one of the two twins in this movie that also kind of mounts to a very predictable, admittedly, anti-climax, I'll call it. But I for one, really like this movie. And just the opening of the movie, it opens with this nice countryside. It's probably like the summer and these Austrians own a farm or something. And the boys are playing outside, and the boys, like, you know, they're best friends. They do everything together, kind of hide and seek. It made me think of a time before game consoles and the internet and Netflix, when we actually played outside. And there was something very refreshing about that opening scene. scene to me, just seeing those two boys. This is before the movie has done anything but introduce us to what the trailer would suggest are the protagonists.
It's a garbage fail movie.
I like the movie a lot. You'd be nice.
Here's the thing. I know your taste in film, so what I'm saying about this movie, I don't think is aimed at you, because I know that you like every type of genre. You're not like, you don't follow the trends of horror. You like the horror that you like. You like good horror, bad horror. So the comments I'm making aren't aimed at you. I just want you to know. So don't, like, I get that you like the movie, but don't get defensive, because.
But no, I'm just saying, like, really, like, I feel like this was critically amazing other than its predictability.
I feel like it was one of those fancy donut shops that sell out all their donuts by 10 a.m. Like, the donuts are delicious and trendy, but they're just empty calories. This movie is empty calories. Now, I don't think horror movies need to have twists. I don't think they need to be terrifying. But I was watching this Goodnight Mommy, right? And 2 minutes in, I went, oh, it's just one kid. It's just Luke. It's just there's Lucas. Ilias. I was like, oh, it's just one kid. So I was like, I don't think this is a twist because it's so evident. So the whole time I'm watching, I feel like, all right, so 100 yards away, right, there's a wall, a spiked wall. And you're just walking slowly towards it in a straight line. So you know it's coming. You're moving there slowly. There's no surprises. There's no zigs. There's no zags. There's no talking about reading a book in the bathtub. You're just walking towards mom torture. And there's no surprises. There's no feelings. It's just like, it's well shot, though. I think it's well acted. But all these people are calling it, like, I've been reading reviews, like, they're saying it's terrifying. There's people are saying they didn't get the twist, and I'm like, what? It's just like, it's,
I don't
just,
know. No, hold on. Someone had a serious brain injury.
No, I was reading major websites that were like, can you believe what happened? I'm like, yeah, I can believe what happened. Because I reading around, I feel like I'm one of the few people that don't like this movie, because it is critically loved. In Austria, they submitted it as their best foreign language film for the Oscars. It didn't get picked up, but I just thought the twist wasn't a twist. I thought the twist was going to be that both of the kids were actually alive and the mom was a jerk. Like, I thought she was actually ignoring one of the kids. But that's not the case. Like, I was just like, there's one kid. He's Tyler Durden. And now he's super gluing his mom's lips shut. It's just like there's nothing redeemable about it. I didn't like the characters. It felt like just an art house slog. And I normally love art house slogs. I mean, I'm all for art house. Say that five times. Art house slogs. But this just felt like, just, it was just so clear. I knew where it was going. You're just walking slowly towards it. And it was just, no. So yeah, that's me.
Yeah. And for me, like, it was what, after the boys, like, don't greet the mom, like, they don't even hug her when she comes home, which is at like minute 8 when they first see each other. And then we get to like minute 12. And they're playing. They're having game night, and the boy is whispering to the other boy, and the mother is only addressing. It's very clear. It's not even subtle. She's very clearly only addressing the one boy who's addressing her, and so it's too early in the movie for that to be like, okay, fine. You want to give me the cold shoulder? I'll give it to you. Like, there was no development for that. So at that point, I'm just like, yeah, all right. This is what's happening. It's like 14 minutes in, and there's one boy. And all I'm thinking is, like, what's the deal with the other boy? Is it – and when I realized how predictable it was, I didn't think they were trying to spoon feed it to us. I just think they were totally unsubtle. I think they were untactful. And so they gave it to the wise viewer right away. But I was still expecting, like you said, something else. Like, they're walking towards the spike wall. I see it from a mile. I see it from literally 90 minutes ahead of time. She's walking right. They're going to turn. They know they're going to walk into the spiked wall. So what I'm thinking is there's going to be a clever reveal about whose response. Now, obviously, the living boy is probably responsible for an accident somehow. Mm-hmm. Because,
well, he's burning cockroaches.
Because his brother is dead. His twin brother is dead. And because we acknowledged that at some point there was a twin brother.
Yeah.
And they mention the father, and he says, you know, Dad always lets us do this. And other than that line, the dad is never mentioned, never seen in the movie, which takes place over the course of a long time. So it's like, I figured the big reveal would be when the boy realizes what he did, or maybe he was playing with fire or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wasn't, as I was watching the movie, and I can totally understand how some people would figure out what's going on in the movie or in the first 10 to 30 minutes and then be like, oh, this sucks. Like, they ruined that for me. They took that from me. But I'm thinking like, well, where is it going then? Because that's not the direction. And then they never went anywhere with it. They left it totally on the mystique end, which would be fine if they went Fight Club subtle with the other personality of the dead child.
Yeah.
Even The Uninvited, which wasn't a great horror movie, but it was a very entertaining flick. The Uninvited did that, where the girl had an accident that ended up getting her sister killed. But when she comes home, you know, and what is it? Elizabeth Banks is the mother, the young mother, and she's treating her like the bad person, and her sister is on her side.
Yeah.
And that's one of those movies where it's not Fight Club brilliant, but when you go back and rewatch it, and I'm the person who would do that with The Uninvited, not many people would, you see the subtlety. Like, they really did a good job of setting things up where only the one sister is acknowledged, but it's not in your face obvious. And only the one sister is being heard by the other sister, and it's not really obvious. This movie didn't have that. And so they didn't have tact. And then when they did the reveal anyway, did you notice that even when they gave you the reveal, even if you didn't know it, they were just like, here's the reveal. I'm tied up. You need to untie me. Stop doing this. Stop doing this, Lucas. Stop hurting mommy. I'm your real mother. Your brother died. It's just you. Like, she, you know, she's just saying it in a list of things.
Yeah.
And so that really fell flat as well.
And so, but like all these reviews that are saying it's the most terrifying, squirm-inducing, intelligent movie, I'm like, no, it's not. Like, I don't – you know what? If this movie was like 50% on Rotten Tomatoes or like 60%, I'd be like, all right. But there's like – I feel like I have to like fight back because people are saying how great it is. But it's not – it's like, what? This isn't – I don't even think
Let me just look at snippets. How did you react to the dental floss scene and the super glue scene? What if you were to just criticize those scenes, having not seen all the buildup? Were those not intense scenes if you were to put yourself there, if you were the parent? Like, were those not intense, scary scenes?
I could see how people would like them, but no, because I just knew it was just moving. It was just moving slowly along. And it's like they're going to ramp up the torture. She's going to get hurt somehow. She's going to do this. She's going to do that. Like, I knew they were going to show a shot where she was tied up and she, you know, peed the bed because they wouldn't let her go. I knew they'd show that. Like, I just – I was – the whole time I'm like – it just felt like A, B, C. It felt like I was reading my alphabets the entire time watching it. You know, and I know I've talked about this movie a lot, but Cheap Thrills is a movie about these escalating dares throughout the night, and there's, you know, people losing fingers and body parts, and it grows really gory. But you like the characters, and you feel the desperation, and you don't really know where it's going, so you're into that. And, like, you're into – and, like, I haven't seen Martyrs. But the more you tell me about it, the more I like it, because these people are trying to find a martyr through torture. So it makes logical sense that they want to push someone to a bounds and they can take it, so there's transcendence. Like, that's – there's an art behind that. There's an idea behind that. But there's no idea in this movie. There's no – I felt nothing. Like, I felt like this was the Green Lantern with Ryan Reynolds. He's a great actor. But watching Green Lantern, I felt nothing. Like, I didn't laugh. I didn't cry. Like, I just sat there. So, like, Goodnight Mommy was like the horror, superhero horror film to me. It's well done. It's well done. It's well shot. But it's just, there's nothing. It's just A through Z. Zed.
It sounds like.
So, do you think that. Go ahead.
What's up, Laz?
It sounds like you're saying that the movie is a paint by numbers experience.
Yeah. Really. I think so.
It's just that they did a really good job of painting, you know, inside the lines.
It's shiny.
Yeah.
Like, the lines are immaculately painted. Like,
nice.
This is like it's like a newer Mona Lisa. Like, you know, it's fake, but you're like, it's a good replica. But nothing, like, I don't know. So for me, maybe, and every time I talked about 21st century horror films, people are always like, where's Goodnight Mommy? You know, it's like, no, like, I don't get how people like it. But John, so you've talked about it, but like, how would you sum this up? Why would you say you like this movie?
Well, I'd say two things that you pointed out. It's beautifully shot and very well acted.
Yeah.
And I think that if you are capable of compartmentalizing the element of horror, if you will, sorry to say it. Yeah, sorry, Goodnight Mommy. But if you can compartmentalize the fact of how they completely spoiled the horror element with the horrible reveal and the lack of tact, I think that the individual scenes are all very effective. If you were to only ever criticize one scene and be able to stop saying, I saw it coming from 90 minutes away, well, what if you started at 85 minutes?
Yeah.
What if you started at 70 minutes and watched that 5 minutes? I think that all the scenes are fantastic. I agree that they do not piece together well. But at the same time, I thought that no two scenes in Bone Tomahawk fit well, and I thought that the lines were great, but they never fit well in the scenes. But for some reason, you seem to love it.
Yeah. I get why people – I guess I can get why people like Goodnight Mommy, but I just – you know, it's a really violent movie too, and it goes extreme. And normally I'm not for that kind of film, but I just kind of sat there grumpy.
So, and here's a fair criticism, if you let me. So, it's well acted. It's beautifully shot. Right, we're impressed with the actors. It's rare that I say that I love the acting in foreign language films. So, when I say I like the acting in a foreign language film, and I don't speak the foreign language, that's usually a pretty good nod. This is this writer director team's first movie. So, it's two people wrote it. Those same two people directed it. They've never done a feature film before. So if you had these two people and these same actors and you had a more experienced, better seasoned writer, do you think this could have been a great movie?
Yeah, and I think maybe their next movie will be better because this movie felt like a very gussied up – it felt like a great cinematographer filmed a film school student's thesis film.
Well, hold on. I mean it was – again, it's like –
And you know what I like, though? The Austrian guy who filmed this, he hated horror. So he kind of shot it, you know, more realist, like drama-esque.
Yeah, it was very.
You know, that it looks good, but it felt very much like a first-time feature. Like Bone Tomahawk, the first draft was the final script. So, you know, it was beefy. It was a beefy movie. Like his mustache, Kurt Russell's mustache.
But, you know, one thing I loved about the movie is really, though, because of my experiences, because I thought there would be a different twist, right? Yeah. It's because I didn't think that they were just giving it away, even though I didn't think that was fully intentional how easily they gave it away. I did think there would be a different twist. And because of that, my experience led me to watch this movie wondering who the real antagonist was. Because even if there is only one twin, and I was certain of it, so even if there is only one living twin, right, and the other twin's dead, and the dad's dead, and that doesn't necessarily mean that that really is their mom. And even if it is their mom, we don't know what caused the death. Is there something latent in here? Which one of these is the antagonist? Because they kind of come at each other a little and a little and a little and a little from both directions in terms of domestic violence, kind of roughing up the kid when he gets out of hand. Like, it's not one-sided.
Yeah, but she's dealing with this kid that, like, is talking to somebody else and he disobeys and he like, for a mom that suffered trauma to have an insane – this kid's crazy. So this mom
knows what he's doing. She knows it's because he thinks his brother is there. I mean, it's not like she doesn't realize that.
I mean, she's not a good mom, but she also – I kind of – so for me, like I never thought she was a bad guy. I just thought she was dealing with a crazy kid and she wasn't – you know, she seems like she put herself first. I felt like she got that surgery because she was a TV presenter and wanted to keep her looks. So she's kind of – you know, I don't know if that was from the accident, if they had an accident, but I feel like she was trying to keep her looks for TV. So there's definitely some vainness to her.
But there was also the scene, though, where she says, don't disturb me while I'm resting. I need to rest. And one time when the kids came in, well, when the kid came in, if you will, she faked being asleep. Like, she was just eating a snack and she faked being asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're, why?
She doesn't want to deal with her crazy kid.
What? That's, that, it, there's, that, that's very ambiguously weird. Like, I didn't know what the hell was going on. That was before shit got intense. That was before she got physical with the kid.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, she was a selfish woman, but it's still, it's just not. But see, then you just don't like anybody involved. It's just not.
And then the kids have these weird dreams, these surreal dreams, which were cool dream sequences, but these surreal dreams about, like, the mother in the forest, that weird sequence, like, naked mom in the forest, like, yeah, looking like a demon or something, and her eating the roaches, the weird fixation with the roaches throughout the movie, and the cat, and a lot of weird, like, small animal fixations. I feel like it had a lot of the pieces to be great, and it came down to the, maybe the writing, but more the direction and the execution of blatantly handing it to anyone with an IQ higher than their age. There's just one kid.
Were they just like
15 minutes flat?
Yeah, I feel like there's a pompousness to the direction, and I guess it worked because people love it. But you know, it's funny. I never guess twists. Like, Chubby Checker would hate me because I am inept when it comes to twisting, figuring out twists. You know, like anything regarding twists. Like, you know, I'm not good at with, like, you know, lemon twists. You know, if someone wants a drink with a twist, I'm going to fail miserably. But I got this thing immediately. I don't know.
So, Lazabeth, did you happen to see this movie?
No. I was going to make a quick aside. Like, Mark, I know people say, like, you know, do we reference Kurt Russell enough? I was thinking, like, we don't get enough Chubby Checker references on this podcast.
Hearing what we've said, though, like, are you interested in seeing this movie or disinterested in seeing this movie?
It definitely sounds interesting. It just doesn't sound like something that's going to blow me away, you know?
No.
I've seen a lot of movies where the main appeal of it is that there's, like, a huge plot twist, but when that happens, like, the plot twist is always always underwhelming or barely a plot twist. So I may one day decide to catch this online somewhere, by completely legal means, of course.
It's on Amazon.
Yeah,
Amazon Prime.
Yeah, that's what I meant. But
I'm certainly very excited to see what these guys do next.
Mommy 2. Electric Boogaloo. Tyler Durden returns.
Good morning, Dad.
Good morning, Dad. I like it. All right, so you want to move on to something that we both like, Love and Good?
That's all right. I think that's a good way for us to round this out. And the final movie we will be discussing tonight is Unfriended, which is sort of a techno horror movie, and they take an approach that really hasn't been taken before. The whole movie takes place on one person's laptop monitor, and we get, you know, little blips from other things, but I mean, it's all real time too. So if the movie is, you know, 91 minutes, it means that from the time the movie starts, they may have, you know, edited it or something, but it's meant to be 91 minutes in these characters' lives. So I thought that was kind of cool too, in addition to it basically being a group Skype call where our main character, it's a year anniversary to one of their all mutual friends committing suicide after an embarrassing video of her gets released on social media.
The mother of all embarrassing videos.
The mother of all embarrassing videos. Maybe we'll get into that later. It's bad. It's really bad. But so the girl commits suicide over it, and she's seeing this in the video. And then they get on a group Skype call after a nice little introduction with her boyfriend when they're one-on-one Skyping. I thought they were great characters. I really like meeting these two characters.
And the scene with the sword, too, he, like, threatened her, and she kind of liked that.
That's right. And but then they get this group Skype call. They're really just chatting about whatever, them and all their friends. And then there's this mysterious person on the call, and no one knows who put this person on the call. Turns out to be what they think is a hacker posing as the person who died. And then other weird things start happening. All their social medias are being hacked. And then they start dying one by one as they enter kind of a never would I ever game over Skype. led by this ghost, if you will, or hacker thing. And I gotta say, I walked in not expecting to like this movie, right?
Yeah, me too. I had no urge to watch it until I started reading about like AV Club and people. It's like people are championing it now. Like it's becoming the go to, you know, movie to defend.
Like, yeah, I saw the trailer. I thought this is going to be garbage. I saw extended trailers online. I thought it was going to be garbage. I read reviews. I figured they were people who were just like, we want to get sent more screeners that we get first review on our website, so we're going to be nice. Which is maybe, by the way, why some people romanticize their reviews of Goodnight Mommy. I have a lot of good things to say, but you also heard me give it a few technical slams in the delivery, so maybe that was what was happening. But when I sat down and watched this movie, I immediately liked the characters, and I thought of two movies in particular, or three movies in particular. I thought of Chronicle, Afflicted, and Cloverfield, which are all found footage movies, and in all those movies in the first 10 minutes, I didn't give a shit if they turned out to be horror or sci-fi. I liked these characters so much that I would watch whatever comedy or drama that their story took them to. And with these kids, I was really liking it. Just their Skype call, just their interactions. They seemed like real people having real kid conversations, reacting in normal ways. And that held throughout the movie for me.
And this is going to sound crazy, but a lot of my real life experiences have blended with this movie. I was a teacher. I'm not going to say in what state, what school, but something happened between a teacher and a student. And the student that blew the whistle on the whole ordeal became ostracized because all the students loved that teacher that got fired. So this kid that did the right thing got ostracized, and a year later ended up, killing himself. So this kid was in my class for a little bit. So that, as much as people say that these kids are just terrible stereotypes, like I kind of saw this a little bit. And I also lived in Korea for a year where it's massively connected by internet. And the kids out there, there's a lot of cyberbullying overseas because, I mean, it's really connected on the internet. And there's cyberbullying everywhere. But, out there, they're trying to get laws to kind of end anonymous bashing. Like, you need a legit email. But there's a lot of suicides. There's a lot of, people, cyberbullying is a real thing. You know, in the past, I think when we were in middle school, you kind of had to, like, if you were a bully, you had to get down and dirty and beat people up. But nowadays, you can kind of slam people online. So having seen this kind of, between the suicide and witnessing cyberbullying, like this movie felt like these kids felt more believable than they should have had I not been around that.
Yeah, and again, like one of my criticisms when I saw the trailer for this low budget thing was like, I don't care how good they think they are. There's no way this is going to work when the whole thing is on a computer monitor.
Yeah. And
it worked fine.
And you know what's funny? Like, and today you kind of, you're looking at your phone, you're typing, you're writing, you're watching TV, like multitasking is a lot more evident today. So on the screen, she's listening to Spotify and all this stuff. But what I like the most about it is the character progression. Like the main girl, she's bad business. Like at first she starts really nice, but then you learn more about her and like, she is not good, but she thinks she is. Like she's sitting there going, we're good people. Like I think she thinks she's a good person, but the stuff she does in this movie is insane. Blair's the main girl that you're on her screen. Like, she's bad business.
Yeah. I think that's, I identified with it. Not directly, but like, I kind of felt like I've seen that a lot though, where the individuals who are bad don't realize that they're bad. They do all of these isolated incidents against other people, but they never view the sum of them. And they also never properly reflect on the impact of any one event. Like in this, let's talk about this horrible video. So the video is basically a girl is drunk out of her mind, and she ends up throwing up and like shitting herself, and like it's very embarrassing. And then her friends post it online, and at the end of the movie, we find out they were some of these friends involved in the Skype call. And the girl who posted it is who seems to be our protagonist, our main character, the person whose screen we're seeing, right?
Yeah.
And so like, but she, even then, she's like, no, I was drunk. It was just a party. This is what anyone would have done that. Like in her head, I don't think she's just saying that because the gun is to her head. I think that she's saying that because that's how people who do mean things behave. They immediately, the moment they did it, they already rationalized it. They didn't even have to think about it.
And then she led her boyfriend to believe that she was a virgin, but she had slept with his best friend twice.
Right, but it was just one person, and yeah. It was just once, and we were really drunk.
Twice.
The second time, no, we wanted to see if it was real. We wanted to see if it was real, you know. But like to her, she's doing what was in her best interest, and she wanted to see. Like I think that there's a lot of I think that we all know people who are like this.
Yeah, and like. I think the character's relatable, and also the way they filmed it was pretty amazing. Like, they just put GoPros on computers. There was 12 total days of shooting. They shot 4 days where they did, like, 85-minute takes, 10-minute takes. I mean, that's crazy. These kids did an 85-minute take where they're screaming and yelling and crying. So, I mean, considering that this is kind of like the first of its kind of, like, Skype acting, I know people do auditions on it all the time, but to keep that energy up for 85 minutes, like, that's... And the way they GoPro'd it, and they did like a big, you know, they were hardwired and they were all in one house. And then they set up a big audio thing so they couldn't really hear each other. So they couldn't like so it was all really technically and the editing was a beast. So, I mean, this is like a horror movie that on the surface you're like, ah, oh, it's that stupid Facebook movie. But like technologically, it's pretty inventive. Like it's it's very inventive.
So, Mark, I got to ask you, as someone with experience working the film crew. Like, what would your reaction be if someone wanted you to work on this movie and they described the movie to you? Yeah, the whole movie is just basically going to be, like, basically a big Skype call.
Yo, I'm in.
Yeah.
Because, all right, you're in one house, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, there's not really much – there's some art direction. I wouldn't say the lighting's too extreme because once you set it, it's set. So there are grips and electrics. Biggest problem with this, though, is keeping the set quiet during those 85 minutes. So that probably would have been a beast. But as far as moving parts and cars and extras and wardrobes, I mean, I've worked on movies with mass quantities of this. And so I'd sign me up. I'll work 12 days on a movie. You know, like, that's awesome. Like, you know, sometimes you have, like, you know, Captain America was like 100. So it's like, hey, I'll do 12 days on a movie and say I work the whole thing.
You just chill inside a house.
Time. And I mean, the days were absolutely long. But yeah, I mean, it's basically just keeping people quiet, essentially, is what it is. Sign me up.
Yeah. So I guess what I was trying to get at is that it may be a little bit easier, but it doesn't mean there was no effort involved in making this type of movie.
The setting the technology up with the GoPros, the computers, the sound. And then getting the performances out of 85-minute single takes occasionally for these kids. So there's heavy pre, a short shooting schedule, and then a very heavy post-production. Because you're watching a screen, and on the screen there's five different things going on. This girl's typing, then she's erasing, she's typing, she's erasing, she wants to get it right. So, I mean, the post-production, the layers upon layers of editing is extreme. So I wouldn't want to edit the movie, but working on it would be a breeze.
Man, that typing, by the way, it seems so simple, like someone typing, you know, typing a message or a text or something in the movie. We saw it happen in a lot of things kind of trending in the last few years. Like, I think House of Cards, they kind of made it really popular. And then other movies and shows started doing it, too, where you see the on screen, like a thought bubble, the typing.
Yeah.
But it's always fast. It's always seamless. Right. It doesn't come with any delay. And this, and I've never noticed a flaw in that. In this, though, it was really like someone typing. Like, you start typing, you stop. You're waiting to see what someone else says. You see the dot, dot, dot bouncing around, and then it stops. And then you're like, oh, they're thinking. Like, you're waiting to hear what they say, and you get anxious. So you text, like, hey, are you there? Come on. Like, and you write something, you leave it, you delete part of it, you rewrite it. Like, this is all so simple, but... that really caught my attention, and it impressed the shit out of me.
And then you know what else impressed me? Whenever, like, so this ghost, I think the girl comes back, and she has a sense of humor, actually, for a murderous ghost. But she would, like, there's a group, and then they see this bubble, and they don't know who it is, so they call this girl Val, who they don't like. That girl Val ends up killing herself by drinking bleach. But this ghost is, like... What was I getting at? I don't know. I just kind of like how the ghost messes with them. And that girl was kind of a, you know, in all the videos you saw of her, she definitely was a sassy one. So I feel like this was like a sassy, murderous ghost messing with,
it's the ghost of a 17-year-old girl who was partying.
And then, like when that girl admitted she was lying with the cheating, the Spotify list was like, oh, you're such a liar. Like, this ghost was like, this ghost was doing playlists and, like, you know, posting pictures. Like, so let's say the three of us are on right now, and John, you did some, we all did something terrible a year ago. Like, on my Facebook page, pictures of you would pop up on my page. Like, Mark, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm not doing anything.
Yeah. Like one of us posted it.
Yeah. And so we didn't do it. The ghost did it. But this ghost is like really having a great time messing with these kids. I think the violence was like the least fun part of it, like when the kids off themselves.
I just want, very in case it's not painfully obvious, I loved this movie, loved it. But there was one big flaw, and okay, it's, you know, there's a budget going on, and I think they handled the flaw well. They walked in understanding this flaw, but whenever the kids are going to get killed, there's all of a sudden bad reception.
Wait, what?
Yeah, right. It gets shot. But okay, fine. Like, they're not dealing with a big budget. It's all on a monitor anyway, so it adds some drama to them just walking off screen and dying. Okay, fine. But, like, the kid in the blender. Now, I laughed. I love gory scenes. I love stupid shit like that. But the ghost basically possesses you when it's your time to die and makes you kill yourself. Yeah. And this kid takes a blender, he moves it, or it's right next, it's inside of, you know, his Skype camera, and he's putting his hand in the blender like, like he's just putting it in himself. And at that point, you know, it's like conceptually that's phoned in for me, but yeah, it was handled very, very well. I mean, on paper, in my opinion, on paper, this is just as unforgivable as the horrible reveal and lack of subtlety in Goodnight Mommy. However, in execution, they dealt with this much better than the flaw in Goodnight Mommy. In Goodnight Mommy, the flaw was the execution, whereas in this, the flaw was a reality. They need to show these kids dying in different ways. They have no budget. It's all on computer monitors and little squares. And so at the end of the day, my horrible criticism of the movie turns out to still be a kind statement about the movie with how they handled it.
Yeah. No, and
that's my worst criticism, by the way. That's my only criticism that's negative.
Yeah, and that was definitely the weakest link. But I read a review for this, and I kind of like what they said. Some guy called this a mean, potent little movie.
And a mean, potent little movie.
It is a mean little potent movie.
I feel like you would have written that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just a mean little potent movie that has some surprises. It's better than it has any right to be. I think it's a very effective horror film. I don't think it is, you know, Rosemary's Baby, but not, it wasn't trying to be Rosemary's Baby. For what it tried to do, I think it was very successful. And it could have been a lot more gimmicky, but it wasn't. And so I appreciated that. I liked the evolution of the main character, like just the way that you found out that she filmed the video. She was just bad business. She turned her boyfriend in. She got another guy shot. Yeah, Blair was the worst.
And you know what else is cool is that, like, they did a good job making us believe that the kids couldn't leave the Skype call, and they were still texting, private messaging, emailing, using their cell phone. They called the police in a very timely manner right away in a panic. When her phone wasn't working, she was away from her phone for some reason. She went on chat roulette to find random and went through five different people. It's like, well, you finally got someone to call the police and for the right address. Like, all, like, they're doing everything they can within reason and panic and being kids, right, in this weird situation. So that was cool. But there was one thing that struck out is really weird to me. I'm not going to call this like a criticism, but when Ken, the kid who puts his hand in the blender, right, when it's his turn, when you know that the ghost has picked him to die, all of a sudden there's a camera feed coming from what turns out to be his AC duct in his bedroom. And so all I'm thinking is there. So now it's not just the ghost possessing somebody. There's literally a device that was in his AC ducts in the vent this whole time? Or the ghost just placed it there?
Did he keep it there to, like, spy on people? No, that can't be right.
It was there, and it didn't turn on until it was hit, until he was basically chosen.
So this ghost did AV tech work as well, like IT.
But so what was it? Was it a phone? What was this device? What the hell was? I mean, this is ridiculous. This is like, this is the movie. In all fairness, I've said this before. This is where the filmmakers are pulling a fast one on the audience, but it made for a fun scene.
You know what's funny? I didn't even think about that until you said it.
Yeah. There was a device, and he picked it up. He picked it up. You could see the screen moving as he manipulated the device. There was a device in there with a camera, like a cell phone or something, that was propped up against the vent. So he could, and actually, it would have to not be propped against the vent. It would have to be propped away from the vent, because if it was propped against the vent, it would look down to the floor. Yep. So it had to be carefully propped up on something.
This ghost is good.
Like, did it have a power source? Like, what's going on?
I mean, if this ghost can transfer through thing to thing, like, it probably just, you know, put its ghost juice on it.
But when did this device get there? I mean, clearly the filmmakers pulled a fast one, and I'm not being mean about it. I'm just having fun with it. Because, again, it worked. It made for a fun scene. But when I'm watching, I'm just thinking, like, what is he picking up?
Yeah. And most importantly, what are Lazarus's odds in this movie?
Well, Shannon Elizabeth is not in it, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's got to be a lot lower, right?
So, like, 93%?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty much dead at that point, right?
I think they're all, like, messing around with the ghosts, and you're just kind of chilling.
Yeah, I'm trying to get the internet to work in my head. On my laptop.
You finally get your internet to work and no one's there, and you're like, hello?
Hello?
So, hello? Honestly, I think my odds of surviving this are extremely high. I mean, extremely high.
Nice. Why?
Well, because, like, and I'm sure I'm not alone with this, but I have dealt with a couple of crazy
altergeists,
ex-girlfriends, or crazy in the process of becoming ex-girlfriends. And a lot of people, when someone calls and you pick up and it starts as an argument or it starts out angry, like you're kind of baited, you want to calm them, you want to get to something, you want to just make them stop that, I just hang up. And I've done this even to my family. When people in my family are like really upset about something, they're hysterical about something and they need to calm down, I hang up. They call back, I hang up. They call back again, I hang up. They call back again, finally they're calm. They're like, okay, I'm sorry, I'm cool. Then we talk. So the moment that something weird starts happening, I'm just – see my hand on the Skype? I'm just lowering the computer. Boom. It just goes down. There's not enough time for me to sit around and wait for it to say, oh, no, you better not, or you're going to die. No, I won't even get to see it. I'll just close the – I'll close the computer. And that cripples these concepts in movies. And if the ghost is willing to write that, the ghost isn't going to kill you just because you closed it. The ghost cares. The ghost is invested. The ghost has actions that have rules.
I would just talk to it.
It's almost like terrorism, too. People joke about terrorists, like just – the opposite of dealing with a negotiator. You just start shooting people. John Travolta said it in Swordfish about Serpico. What if he just started shooting people right away?
Oh, I hate that movie, Swordfish.
Dog Day Afternoon. But like, you know, it's like you just close the computer. When something horrible starts happening, I don't really get all engaged and worked up in it. I just stop and walk away.
I talk it out. The ghost and I would have left friends.
I don't know, man. Like, the ghost might have sent you a fax that said, if you reveal this message, John dies. And then I got a fax that said, if you reveal this message, Mark dies.
But that's good, because you close your computer. You know, you don't really use your cell phone much. So I'm safe. And I'll be like, I'm not killing John. But listen, I didn't do any of this. All right? I didn't start a fake account to write bad stuff on your thing. I don't even know how I got in on this call. You know, remember that time I bought you lunch? Like, I would work it out with this ghost. I would be diplomatic. I'm like, you know what, Levin Good, he hung up. Don't get mad at him. He just doesn't like, you know, dealing with that kind of stuff. So let him go too. But end of it, you know, we're podcasting with the ghost.
You know, and the kids almost did that at the beginning too. Because at first they were like, when they recognized none of us know who this like spectral Skyper is. Like, okay, let's all hang up and call again.
Yep.
But then when it's still there, they they just let it be. They're like, oh, it must be a glitch. Like, I've never seen or heard of anything like that, but they do whatever. We're just letting that slide. But, like, they just let that happen. Like, I don't know. I would have been pretty concerned. I've been like, let's FaceTime or something else. And then if it keeps happening somewhere else, you know something's really up.
Yeah.
So what was your favorite part of this movie?
I guess the ending, finding out that she filmed it, finding out, like, that girl was bad business. And, like, I guess I liked that she wasn't a mustache-twirling villain-ess. She said we're good people. Like, I thought that was pretty three-dimensional.
I think she meant it, too.
I think that was pretty three-dimensional in a teen horror movie about Facebook murders. I thought that was an interesting character. So that was my favorite. What about you?
Honestly, you know, just as much as I did like the last, you know, 3 to 5 minutes of that movie, I like the first 5 minutes when we meet these totally normal, credible, personable kids joking about virginity and prom night and playfully kind of jesting with the boy negotiating for Skype sex or something. But, like, it's all very playful, and it reminded me very accurately of, not that I had Skype, but of being that age, you know. And again, it's like I said about Afflicted, Chronicle, Cloverfield. Cloverfield, the first 15 minutes is at a party, a going away party for someone who's going to go move to Japan. If you stop that movie at 14 and a half minutes before the ground starts shaking, I would have wanted to see the next 80 minutes of this person's life going to Japan and their friends dealing with it. Like, I wouldn't have cared about the Cloverfield monster.
Yeah.
I loved meeting the characters so much that I didn't care what genre the movie was.
Lazweth, did you throw me a party when I moved to South Korea?
Yeah, I just didn't tell you about it. It was pretty fun.
They were celebrating the going away instead of throwing you a going away party.
I figured it would have been too awkward to have you there. You know?
It's getting out of here.
Yeah.
All right,
speaking of getting out of here, I think it's time to say goodbye. Actually, but before we do, any plugs you want to make?
Movies, films, and flicks. Stop by the iTunes app. Rate and review us. You know, just if you like the pod, make sure to review us. Make sure to rate us. We would love to build up our numbers on that. And once again, I just want to thank you for subscribing, listening. We think it's an honor that you spend your time listening to our ramblings. So I just want to say thank you to all of our listeners.
Yep, and you can also listen to us on Blog Talk Radio. That's Movies, Films, and Flicks with an X, not a CKS. And you can find us on Twitter, that same thing, Movies, Films, Flicks with an X, and MFF Horror Corner and Shark Dropper, which hosts a lot of other podcasts. And, regardless of some divided reviews, I'm pretty grateful for all three of these movies. I think they were all three some really good experiences.
Nah.
Oh, you're such a jerk.
Yeah. Alright, guys, for my co-hosts Mark Hoffmeyer,
Kurt Russell,
and John Levengood.
Ray Liotta was never in a movie with Kurt Russell? Was he ever?
Stargate.
I've been your host, John, last week.
No.
Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.
Hey, what am I doing in this Stargate?
Why do I have this accent?
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.